You're listening to the Joint Genome Institute's Natural Podcast, a podcast about natural products and the science of secondary metabolism.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Natural Podcast. This continues the series of interviews we recorded at the Society for Industrial Microbiology and Biotechnology, or SIMBY's, Natural Products meeting earlier this year. And today we have our conversation with Professor Allison Narayan from the University of Michigan. I hope she'll accept this description, but I'd say that Allison is not one of the more normal kinds of natural products people we usually talk to. She's a chemist and describes her work as exploring and exploiting biocatalysts, that is, using enzymes to do chemical reactions. Obviously, in my work in genome mining, we have an awful lot of crossover where us genome miners get really jazzed about finding enzymes that do unusual or unprecedented chemistry. So it's super fun to hear about what folks are up to in a slightly different niche in chemical enzymology. So we talked about her JGI DNA synthesis project to explore the chemical capabilities of flavin monooxygenases, and more broadly about the field of biocatalysis and what needs to be done across science to get to a point where we can predict an enzyme's synthetic capabilities. Also, along the way, I declared a position on candy corn, which is perfect timing for an October podcast release. I hope that doesn't get me canceled. The monthly schedule seems to be working out, so expect lots more to come. Maybe a bonus episode soon, too. Thanks for listening and enjoy this conversation with Allison Narayan.
Well, welcome, everyone. It is my pleasure to introduce our guest today, Professor Allison Narayan from the University of Michigan. Dr. Narayan is currently associated with the chemistry department as well as the life sciences department. So welcome, Allison, to today's podcast. And with your background, this is pretty fun. We've been talking with a lot of people who actually have been classically trained in synthetic chemistry, as were you, and then made their way into the field of natural products in some way, shape, or form. And so do you want to tell us a little bit about, you know, what got you into natural products and got you excited about the world of natural products?
Oh, where did it all begin?
Yeah. I'd love to hear people's origin stories.
For me, the initial attraction to natural products was dual. The beauty of the structures and also the challenge in thinking about making them. So I really came at it not necessarily based on the biology, really just from, as a simple organic chemist, can I make that big, beautiful molecule? And so I would like to think I've evolved a bit since that time. And I would say now the primary reason I'm interested in the world of natural products is also twofold, but for different reasons, to learn about how nature builds molecules. Mm-hmm. Because nature does this with such elegance, and also to take advantage of the biological properties that these molecules have and discover what's possible from them. Because we have all of these molecules, we know very little about what the majority of them do. We have in-depth biological studies on a sliver of the molecules nature provides to us. But, you know, in my lab, we like to ask questions about, like, what don't we know about this molecule? How do we discover more about what it can do? And as chemists, take those structures as inspirations to really start making other molecules related to those scaffolds.
So I think I associate your work with the term biocatalysis. I wonder would you say that's fair?
I think that's fair.
Okay.
And, you know, I always use it as the first word in the title of my talk.
Right.
100% fair to make that association.
So I guess what is the conceptual difference between a biocatalyst and an enzyme?
I love that you asked this question because I have this question. We have this discussion internally in my group quite frequently. Mm-hmm. Okay, so imagine this sentence comes across your desk. We're developing this enzyme into a biocatalyst.
Mm.
Wasn't it already a biocatalyst? And so,
I mean, that's what I was taught enzymes are, right?
Yes. And so that's why I don't like that sentence.
Okay.
I think that sometimes we think about enzyme function as, you know, we think about the natural function versus can we take this enzyme that nature has given us and develop it into a catalyst that we can use for many different things.
Okay,
but so I think they're the same thing. So I would rephrase that sentence and say we are developing this enzyme to, we're exploring the function of this enzyme or its synthetic utility. But an enzyme is a biocatalyst. I would say those are the same in the Venn diagram. Mm-hmm.
Do you need less specificity to be a broadly useful biocatalyst? Is that the difference?
Oh, a broadly useful biocatalyst. So we have a lot of, you know, conversations. I think a lot about this as well. Like, is specificity good or bad when it comes to biocatalysis? Mm-hmm. You want your reactions to be very selective in terms of the products that they're making. And you want to have good binding to your substrate and high turnovers.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you have those things, can you also have something that works on every substrate that you give it? Usually not. The question of, do you need something that's promiscuous for it to be useful? I'm not in a process chemistry route, right? Because there you just need to build one molecule. Mm-hmm. But what I would say is where promiscuity is helpful is in an academic lab, for example, where you don't want to necessarily engineer your enzyme for every different reaction that you want to do. If you're not looking to develop a commercial process, you want to have the ability to build different types of molecules. Or if you're a medicinal chemist, you want to have enzymes that you can apply in a route towards, you know, many different compounds in the same family. And so there you want it to have some promiscuity in the substrates that it operates on.
Got it. Okay. Okay.
So when you're developing these biocatalysts coming from more of the chemistry background, you know, you're talking about promiscuity and substrate specificity, but when you kind of are applying them to making a compound, do you also take into account, you know, how are they going to behave in certain solvents or certain reactions or mixtures, temperature? Do you take that into account, or do you in your lab focus mainly on, you know, what can we feed this and what can it actually turn over?
So that's an excellent question. I think that we need enzymes with good physical properties to work with to make them good catalysts to then look at substrate scope, for example. So I think you can't get to the second part without exploring the first part. Mm-hmm. And so I would say we don't necessarily develop enzymes that have those properties. Sometimes we'll do engineering to improve the physical properties of a protein and make it easier to work with. But sometimes what we're looking to do is just find the natural enzymes with the best properties to then work with further. So for example, we've built a library of flavin-dependent monooxygenases with the help of JGI's DNA synthesis grant. And that having a whole panel of these enzymes allows us to ask the questions, which ones express the best in E. coli? Which ones are the most thermally stable? And those are mm-hmm. important to us before we ask those next questions of, will it work on many different substrates or does it do a reaction selectively?
So it's sort of, does it work in the first place versus does it, is it useful?
I like to think, you know, every enzyme, you know, is a little snowflake.
You have to treat it. It's a delicate snowflake.
It is a delicate snowflake.
I mean, that's not wrong necessarily.
Right. Yeah. Or maybe they're like different types of snowballs, right? We're in Michigan. We're not physically in Michigan right now, but I am from Michigan and it's winter. So the snow is on my mind. But, you know, if you have a delicate little snowflake that just melts in your hands, that's not going to be great to work with. If you have an icy hard pack snowball that you can't destroy, like, you know.
Let's
pick that one.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Because we want everyone in the lab to be able to work with it, not just the person that has, like, the delicate protein touch, right? And we want other people around the world to be able to duplicate the, you know, results that we have with these enzymes too. So the more robust the better.
Nice.
That makes sense. Yeah, it's been a long time since I've actually isolated some proteins off the bench, and I am well aware of the pitfalls of that not working out well
in the first tears.
Place. Yeah, for sure.
And I mean, you know, this is beyond my my expertise in, you know, being able to predict which enzymes might have better physical properties to work with. But I mean, we've found sometimes enzymes that are the most similar within our libraries can have drastically different properties in terms of their solubility, their stability.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
It's hard to predict how one enzyme will behave compared to another. And
right. Things that precipitate out or just have a very short half-life. So,
With your grant with JGI, how many flame monooxygenases are you sequencing? Sort of kind of along that vein of, you know, if you have one or two and you compare them and they behave very differently, can you make any association that might help? Like if you have an unknown sequence or new flavin monooxygenase, you could say, oh, Allison, you know, sequenced all of these, she tried these, this, if you have this sort of motif, you might have a chance. And I guess with along that line with JGI, like how many are you sequencing currently?
Yeah, with our collaboration with JGI, we basically designed a library that includes hundreds of different flavin-dependent monooxygenases. Mm-hmm. And so there are different ways that we decided which sequences made it onto that list. So the majority of them are natural sequences. And so we built a library that was densely populated in sequence space around a few enzymes that we have studied in depth. So some of these that were initially identified by Russell Cox, like TRPB.
Explain to my audience what a flavin monooxygenase does.
Some protein families are defined by their cofactor. And so when I say flavin-dependent monooxygenase, I'm talking about the cofactor, which is flavin. Mm-hmm. One of the wonderful things about flavin proteins is that they're bright yellow.
Yeah.
If the flavin cofactor is in the oxidized form. Yeah. And so you see your protein, it's very gratifying when you do a protein purification of this, like, neon yellow band coming off of your column and collecting that.
It's a good day.
Such a good day. And so the flavin is the cofactor. And the kinds of flavin-dependent enzymes we're working with, the cofactor is bound throughout the catalytic cycle. Mm-hmm. So that cofactor stays in the active site. And then the other part of that, the monooxygenase, has to do with the mechanism. And so these enzymes use O2, and one of those oxygen atoms gets incorporated into our product, and one of those oxygen atoms from O2 ends up as a molecule of water.
Okay, so oxygenases, they're oxidizing other molecules.
Correct.
Yep.
And they're beautiful flavins. They're bright yellow, very fun. So in our collaboration with JGI, we put together our wish list of sequences for flavin-dependent monooxygenases, and there are different reasons each of those sequences made it onto the list. And so some of them are natural sequences. Mm-hmm. Actually, the vast majority are natural sequences, and we chose several of them to be highly related to enzymes that we have been studying since day one in my lab that do oxidative dearomatization chemistry on arenes. So the other reason that sequences made it onto our list is because we wanted to have diversity. And so we wanted to profile across that protein family.
Okay.
To sample that sequence space and have as diverse of a protein library within that family as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one more category of sequences that we worked with JGI on, and those are ancestral protein sequences. And so starting from some of the enzymes that we had the most data on and knew the most about, working with my collaborator, Charlie Brooks, who's also at the University of Michigan, and a really talented graduate student, Chad, he predicted the ancestors that those enzymes could have arisen from.
Okay. So sort of a phylogenetic reconstruction.
Exactly.
Kind of
yeah. Working backwards in time.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Great. Okay. What are we looking to monooxygenate?
Ooh, everything.
Really?
Well, we've asked different types of questions with our library. Uh-huh. And so one of the questions we've asked this with this library is to try to understand the selectivity of the reaction and if there are certain sequence features that tell us about or help us to predict where on the substrate that oxygen atom is going to be mm-hmm. delivered mm-hmm. in the product, and also the stereoselectivity of the reaction. So that is what face of the starting material that oxygen atom is going to be delivered to
right.
in the flavin-dependent reaction. And so we had some theories that we wanted to test out about which residues were important. But one of the things that happened is when we would make substitutions to test that hypothesis through site-directed mutagenesis, we would end up with dead enzymes. So often when you start monkeying around with your active site and making these blunt changes, you mess things up, which is maybe not surprising. And so taking this approach of using the predicting the ancestors that could give rise to two different selectivities allowed us to resurrect those proteins.
I see.
Test their function, and they do the chemistry beautifully, which was very exciting. Mm-hmm. And also then learn about the relationships of the sequence and the selectivity.
Got it. Okay, very cool.
And one of the amazing things that we learned through this study is that our predicted ancestral proteins are much more thermally stable than the natural enzymes that we've been working with.
Really?
And so we got some rocks of catalysts, like rocks in a good way, in terms of their stability that we can now work with in the lab. And that's something, you know, ancestral protein prediction, reconstruction is a whole field. There's a lot of work around this. And so that is something that people have shown in study after study, that you can get to more thermally stable proteins using this approach.
And that's fascinating.
That's weird. I hadn't heard that before. Why is that? Why would that be the case?
It's a great question. If you dive into the literature, you'll find different answers to that question. Uh-huh. One that you will come across frequently is that we're predicting the ancestors, right? We're going back in time.
Yeah.
And the planet was hotter millions and billions of years ago.
Like really early on.
We're going way back in time.
It was way back in time.
Okay. And like when these first evolved. Yeah.
So that's a theory that's there. I don't necessarily know if I buy into that. I'm curious about the algorithms that are used to do these predictions.
Yeah.
And if there's some feature of how the sequences that are predicted that gives rise to more stable proteins.
Interesting.
So I'm not sure why.
Yeah.
No, but it is a result that has a functional benefit for us,
right?
Being chemists working with enzymes in a lab.
Totally. Yeah.
Okay. And so, you know, we've done this approach of the ancestral protein reconstruction in a few different families, and we've seen that result consistently.
Okay.
Getting to more thermally stable enzymes.
Okay. Okay.
Which is always a happy day in lab when you've got a more thermally stable protein, less working in the cold room. You
That's
know?
Right. That's right. Yep.
So when you have these thermally stable proteins, I mean, what from your perspective, like what temperature would you want to push them to be able to still be catalytically active or to still be?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question, and you know, there is a lot of literature around enzymes from thermophilic organisms where their peak activity is at an elevated temperature, right? Mm-hmm. We don't necessarily see that the activity of our enzymes is better at higher temperatures, but it's something that we'll empirically determine with a given enzyme that we're interested in studying to do a profile and look at the yields and kinetics of the reactions at different temperatures. Yeah. Okay. And it's not something that it's like always the same. So I would say we run enzymatic reactions anywhere from 4 degrees to room temperature to slightly elevated. We don't have any reactions that we're doing in like boiling water.
Yeah. Okay. Do you have a, whether it's in the JGI project or not, do you have a favorite biocatalysis story you could tell us?
Oh, a favorite biocatalysis story. You know, like every day.
Every day there's a new
the
story?
Next new favorite biocatalysis story.
That's great.
Well, we talked a little bit about flavin-dependent monooxygenases. Mm-hmm. Another class of enzymes that my lab loves to work with are non-heme enzymes. Mm-hmm. And we work with them in a couple different flavors. So non-heme enzymes, it just means that they need iron.
Right.
They have iron in their active site, but it's not in the form of a heme. So you don't have a porphyrin around the circumference of that iron. We just have the iron itself ligated into the protein. So we work with Riesky oxygenases that are non-heme iron-dependent enzymes, and also another class, it's a mouthful to say, alpha-ketoglutarate-dependent non-heme iron dependent enzymes. We need to come up with a catchy one, because that often they're abbreviated to from alpha ketoglutarate to just AKGs. In my lab, the students working with that class of enzymes call themselves the non-heme team.
Do they have shirts?
I think we need shirts. It's like screaming, put me on a t-shirt, non-heme team. We need like a whole superhero outfit, you know? Okay, so I will tell you a story that involves those two classes of enzymes, the non-hemes and also our lovely flavins.
Great.
Okay, so we were interested in doing this two enzyme sequence with one first reaction catalyzed by a flavin-dependent enzyme, second reaction catalyzed by a non-heme enzyme. Mm-hmm. And they're both enzymes that require oxygen for the chemistry to occur.
Sure.
And so we usually start on small scale in the lab. So we'll run things in like little Eppendorf tubes or in 96 or 384 well plates. But then the fun really starts when you're like scaling up, you know?
Okay.
How are you going to scale up your reaction? And so I'll never forget one day I like was in the lab, and Tyler Doyen, who was one of the very first graduate students to work in my group, it looked like he had like a giant thing of like candy corn on his bench. And I was like, what is that? It's beautiful. It's like, imagine like a conical tube, like a 50 mil like Falcon tube that like visually looks like a piece of candy corn. Right.
Oh, okay.
So it's like colorless.
Just layers of color.
Colorless at the tip, bright yellow in the middle, and orange at the top.
Okay.
Okay. I was like, Tyler, like, what is that? And he was like, I'm making tropolone, which is the product of that two enzyme sequence. Mm-hmm. Tropolones are bright orange in color.
Okay.
So at the top, where you have the interface between the atmosphere and the reaction, plenty of oxygen, everything's going fine. The reaction, both reactions proceed through, and you get the bright orange.
Right.
The
right,
product of the first reaction, the product of the flavin-dependent reaction, bright yellow, it turns out. And then in the tip, nothing was happening at all. No chemistry was going on. So,
because the oxygen's not getting there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or we had like consumed all of the oxygen that was in solution.
Right.
And so that became the rate limiting reactant.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's my favorite, and I had have never
that's
seen
quite
it
a visual,
recreated to look quite that beautiful as like what Tyler was able to achieve that day. Uh-huh. And I don't know if it's related, but also like my lab loves candy corn, and I feel like. Candy
That's
corn
just wrong. I don't know what to tell you.
It's like a divisive candy. It's like people love it or they hate it.
I hate it.
There's no one that stands in the middle on that.
Natural Podcast stands against candy corn.
We're going to get that on a t-shirt.
Yes. There you go.
You know, every year I like to have like a handful of candy corn, and it starts out and it's good. The first couple pieces. And then by the third, it's like, oh, so sweet. So sweet. Okay. But then imagine though. Okay. My group, I brought in like a 10-pound thing of candy corn. I like put it in a candy dish in our group room. It was gone in one day. Oh my gosh.
The non-heme team stands in favor of candy corn.
It kind of was disturbing. I was hoping that like people were like hoarding it at their desks or something, but they confirmed that it had just been completely consumed.
Grad students need calories from somewhere. If it's not free pizza at the seminar, then it's going to have to be the candy corn.
I try to switch it up and bring in fruit and things like that in between the 10-pound bags of candy corn.
Do you think we can get candy corn to sponsor the podcast?
Sponsor Allison's research?
Yeah, there we go.
Totally.
Okay, so that's maybe like my favorite memory of like seeing a biochemical reaction looking very cool, but also then thinking about like why does it look that way is very interesting. My favorite thing currently to do in lab is watch our robot.
Okay.
So we have a very simple programmable robot, which is essentially a little arm that's a multi-channel pipette.
Yep.
And you can write a program that tells it exactly what to do. You can get these things for like less than $10,000. And didn't know if the group would use it, but it was like day one, set it up.
Everybody loves a robot.
Everyone loves a robot.
But right? The question is, does the robot like candy corn?
I don't know. but I can't get enough of this thing. There's something about watching this like set up thousands of reactions at a time that's just like so satisfying. And so I will often whenever it's in action, I go and I just stand there and I'm like, oh, this is so great. And I think back to when I was a graduate student doing total synthesis, where our gold standard was if you're doing three reactions a day, like that's a good level of productivity, you know, if you can do three reactions start to finish and understand what happened in each reaction, clean NMRs, like that was a good day.
That was very productive.
And now I look at this and it's like, oh, this is amazing. You know, you could do 3,000 reactions in a day as long as you have a way to analyze all of them. And I think that's one of the things I love about biocatalysis. You can really design your experiments in a way that's data rich, and you can really just like learn so much, which then enables you to ask bigger questions and accomplish bigger, lofty goals.
I think that, that's really neat. I think like is your big picture idea, and one could envision a few years out from coming from a chemistry background, you know, open up Sigma catalog, you can pick out which reagents you need. Now you can almost go to a catalog and you could say, oh, I want to create this molecule. What enzyme could I go to that would install that moiety? Because maybe you can't do it yet synthetically because you have reactive groups around it. And so is that your goal, I guess, in the next...
Yes, you are describing my dream.
Okay.
I think that, you know, there are several barriers to get to that place. So the first is we don't know the substrate scope of many enzymes. And so we have limited information. There's a lot of work to do. And that makes biocatalysis a great area to operate in because there's just so much information that we still need. And that's the kind of information that chemists need to plan an enzyme into a synthesis and know they're going to have that catalyst that will work to or at least have a shot at it, right? To like, you know, plan that in and make that a solid retrosynthetic design. Also, functionally, the supply of enzymes, right?
Yeah.
And so the three of us sitting here are not afraid of DNA or growing a little E. coli to make a protein of interest that you'd want to work in. But that's not like it's not a standard operation for most organic chemistry labs. And so thinking about, you know, how do we as a field evolve to maybe even include that, or how do we make enzymes more available commercially? And I mean, it's not new. Like, you can buy panels of enzymes. Like, you know, you've always been able to get lipases and epoxide hydrolases and, you know, a limited number. But what we don't have is, you know, the same breadth as what we have in how you can buy ligands, right? We can't buy enzymes the way that you can buy ligands at this point in time. But that was going to change. It's going to change.
So how does that change? So, like, so, okay. you know, I'm a data guy, right? And so I think about, I guess maybe, what is your perspective then on being able to tackle that kind of specificity or function or you know, substrate promiscuity angle? Are we going to be able to ever predict that, do you think, from your experience with working with all these different kinds of enzymes and mutations and everything else? Do you see a predictability to this that we will eventually be able to tackle, or is that just going to be end up too hard and too chemically weird?
I think that it's still a challenge at this point.
Oh, it's for sure.
Time.
It's impossible right now. I think it's impossible right now.
But I think that is the direction we need to move in.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've seen, you know, work from Matt Sigmund's lab and Alon Espero-Guzik that shows the parameterization of phosphines and predictive models that allow you to choose the right phosphine ligand without having to screen ad nauseum.
Yeah.
So a protein, you know, an enzyme is just a big ligand. And so, right, it's more complicated, but I anticipate that we'll be able to use the same types of strategies to develop models.
Okay.
One of our limitations right now, aside from having a much more complicated ligand to wrestle with computationally and parameterize, is that we need good data sets.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, with this question of substrate promiscuity, that's also like another element that needs to be taken into consideration in building these models. And so I think that, you know, one of the reasons I'm so excited about my lab's robot is that it gives us a tool
you
to
can
help
generate
us
that data,
generate those types of data sets and start moving in that direction to at least have the data to do that. Even having that kind of data and sharing it with the community, though, can help inform how synthetic chemists might design an enzyme into a synthesis if you know what chemistry it does on a substrate that's in the neighborhood of a substrate that you might be working with.
Yeah.
And there are other tools that I think are really useful that, again, are set up to take this data. One that I'll point out specifically is a website created by Nick Turner's lab. So Nick Turner is at the University of Manchester. And so he and a really talented student, Will Finnegan, and his group created RetroBioCat. So they have many different enzyme classes represented there, data from the literature and that they've generated in their group, where you can look at different substrates that they have data on for a given enzyme.
So
I think we just need that, but on
a big scale.
Then, you know, we'll have that information for people, specifically chemists, to really plan in a smart, strategic way enzymes into an overall synthetic route. Yes. So when is it going to happen? I don't know. I think we're going to be in business for some time.
Getting physical things into tubes is always the that's the limiting reagent, I think.
Yeah, maybe in the future chemists will have like DNA synthesizers on their bench and they can just make the DNA and do, you know, in vitro transcription translation to make their protein and run a reaction the afternoon. Who knows? I mean, things just, the technology is evolving so quickly that enables this area of science. It's another exciting reason, exciting thing about biocatalysis right now, that I think it is going to look totally different in 5 years than it does right now. So look out.
All right.
Enzymes are coming for you and your flasks.
I'm not sure if that ends on a hopeful note or...
it was hopeful. It wasn't like a threat.
Okay. It's a they're good coming
thing.
For
it's
you.
A good thing that
it's like a good thing. And they will play nicely with other types of reagents. Like...
Yeah. Okay. All right. Great. Well, Allison, thanks so much for talking to us today. This is really an excellent conversation. I'm so happy we did this.
This was a lot of fun. Yeah, thank you for inviting me to be a part of your podcast.
Absolutely. We'll have you back. Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm Dan Udwary, and you've been listening to Natural Podcast, a podcast produced by the U.S. Department of Energy Joint Genome Institute, a DOE Office of Science user facility located at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab.
And I'm Jackie Winter from the University of Utah. You can find links to transcripts, more information on this episode, and our other episodes at naturalpodcast.com.
If you like what we're doing with Natural Podcast and you want to hear more science from JGI and its collaborators, check out JGI's other podcast, Genome Insider, with my colleague Menica Wilhelm. You know, if you like what we're doing here, you'll probably enjoy Genome Insider too, so check it out. Our intro and outro music are by Jezzar.
Please help spread the word by leaving a review of Natural Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, or wherever you downloaded it.
If you have a question or want to give us feedback, tweet us at JGI or to me at Dan Udwary. That's DanUdwary. I'm also on Mastodon with that name at mstdn.science.
If you want to record and send us a question that we might play on air, please email us at jgi-comms. That's jgi-comms@lbl.gov.
And because JGI is a user facility, if you're interested in partnering with us, we want to hear from you. We have projects in genome sequencing, DNA synthesis, transcriptomics, metabolomics, and natural products in plants, fungi, and microorganisms. If you want to collaborate, let us know. Find out more at jgi.doe.gov/user-programs.
Thanks, and see you next time.